from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
2019 starts with a political change in Washington. The Democrats take control of the U.S. House of Representatives for the first time since 2011. What does it mean for the country, for political discourse, and for the pro-life movement? This week on Register Radio, we talk with Register correspondent Loretta Brown. Plus, what were the best movies of 2018? Register movie critic Stephen Gradonis gives us his picks. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register senior editor and co-host for Register Radio. My co-host, Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, is away on maternity leave. The November 2016 midterm elections ended with a divided government. President Donald Trump and the Republican Party retained control of the U.S. Senate, but the Democrats won some 40 seats and swung back the majority in the House of Representatives. That meant the return of Representative Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House for the first time since 2011, and a pretty leftward turn for the chamber. What are the implications for American politics? What can we expect in the coming months? To help us understand a little bit more about where we are politically in Washington and across the country, I'm joined by Loretta Brown, Register correspondent. Welcome, Loretta.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, one of your assignments, I know, over the last few weeks has been trying to cover what has been not necessarily a sea change, but a pretty dramatic change in Capitol Hill. For those who may not be following exactly where we are in the country, what has been transpiring with the 116th Congress?
Well, so there's, as you mentioned, the switch in power in the House. The Democrats control the House now, and that actually does have a lot of implications for some issues that I think matter to Catholics. For example, the abortion issue in particular, we saw an early on push from House Democrats to expand taxpayer-funded abortion just in the first day, you know, within the first hour, 24 hours of them taking power. There was already a push to undo President Trump's policy of not using taxpayer funds for abortion overseas, his expansion of the Reagan-era policy on that. So there's these different movements, and I think there's also talk of even more from Democrats on that issue in particular. I think they've been, now that they have power of the House, they're going to push for these the leftward shift on these social issues. So yeah, I've talked to some of the House Republicans and some Catholic groups, and there's definitely a lot of concern on that issue. But since the Republicans have kind of a more pro-life senators now, actually, in the Senate, the Senate will, I think, stand firm on a lot of this. And also the Trump administration has indicated that they're going to also, you know, push back on this attempt to expand abortion funding and kind of undermine their policies.
What's the significance of the fact that the very first piece of legislation that, as new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi put forward, and the Democratic majority in the House, is a spending bill, ostensibly intending, I know, to sort of end the budget impasse and end the shutdown. But to have such a very clear demonstration of sort of the resurgent power of the abortion industry, is this a message that they're sending not just to the president and to the House Republicans, but to the country at large?
You know, I think so. I think so, because this is a tense time for sure in Washington just on the immigration issue. And there were a lot of things they were pushing for. That spending bill already was not giving President Trump any leeway on his demands regarding border wall funding. And it's the fact that they, during a time where there's, as I said, tense negotiations, they prioritize this, I would say, is an indication that this is going to be a priority for them throughout their time in control of the House. And, you know, many policy analysts that I spoke with agree with me on this. It was alarming. I think, it indicates, and not just, you know, a push for, they talk about the different abortion legislation. So So they talk about improving access and all of that sort of thing. But this is actually more controversial because this used to be common ground, mm-hmm. is that taxpayers should not be forced to fund abortion. And that's where, you know, the Hyde Amendment comes from. That's where Democrats, there used to be more consensus on this. I spoke to Congressman Lipinski, who's one of the last pro-life Democrats in the House. And he mentioned to me that when the Affordable Care Act passed, there were 64 Democrats supporting the STUPAC amendment that prohibited essentially the similar thing, prohibited taxpayer funding for abortion. So to see this now, to see this push, it's not only a signal of abortion as a priority for them, but it's a signal of an extreme push on abortion.
So we're seeing then a statement being made, and it also strikes me that this is also kind of a shot across the bow for how long they might be willing to drag out the shutdown. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm hearing that this shutdown definitely might drag on. I mean, no one can say for sure. There's negotiations going on for sure, but it's on the immigration issue and the fact that they're willing to push on this. I think House Minority Leader McCarthy, I forget the exact word he used, but he essentially called this bill just so unrealistic, like a mockery, a joke, mm-hmm. you know.
right.
And the fact that they led with that, it wasn't even, you know, serious. And it just indicates this is already a very long shutdown at this point. And so for them to not put forward serious legislation, right, you know, people are getting frustrated. This should be a priority. And I see, right, the big disagreement between the Trump administration and Democrats, obviously, on the immigration issue. But I think there actually are a lot of areas of common ground and places they can talk about. I mean, President Trump has indicated flexibility on aspects of his proposal. And so I can't tell you how long this is going to last, but I'm not hopeful it will be resolved in the next few days. We'll see.
Well, especially given that I think Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate side has already said that this bill is essentially dead on arrival, and the president has promised to veto anything that might arrive at his desk should it do so. So
yeah.
Looking at then the prospect of ending the shutdown, we had the president giving a speech, we had the Democratic rebuttal, and based on a lot of the reactions, at least from commentators, no one seemed to do a particularly good job in laying out their case, did they?
Yeah, that's the sense I got, was that the president made this case on the need for border security, and I think people found the Democratic response lacking. People found problems with the argument the president was making. I think it is unfortunately one of those issues where you come in with these notions and it's difficult to change minds. But like I said, there should be more common ground because there are areas where both parties in the past have indicated flexibility. I think President Trump pointed to the Democrats in the past supporting legislation, fencing, that sort of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's just, and President Trump's statements in the past, he's indicated flexibility on different aspects of what the Democrats are demanding as well. So it was a little frustrating to see the address and the response last evening and kind of feel like maybe we're still in the same place, like we hadn't made a lot of headway. But I indicated earlier, there definitely this negotiations talks going on behind the scenes. I think everybody is aware that Americans do not want a long shutdown. I mean, there are definitely people who feel strongly about this on both sides, but at the end of the day, no one's going to be thrilled about not getting their paychecks. So
understood.
Definitely the pressure's on.
Well, looking at the Senate side very briefly, there are still a lot of presidential nominations out there for judgeships, for other appointments. What are the prospects over the next couple of months of any real serious advancement of the nominations?
So I think they're better because we have more pro-life Republican senators in the Senate. I think someone at the March for Life indicated to me that was the case, was that we kind of have higher hopes a little bit for that aspect in the Senate. And it was interesting too. I spoke to people recently about this incident. I think it was towards the end of December, where two Democratic senators questioned a judicial nominee's membership in the Knights of Columbus. And that was concerning. I think there is more of an extreme position from some of the Democratic senators on, they're trying to block these nominations, and they're bringing up these issues that used to be, you know, relatively mainstream and accepted. Like, I don't think people largely regard membership in the Knights of Columbus as controversial.
Well, it's been pointed out, hasn't it, that if that somehow blocks your appointment, then John F. Kennedy couldn't have been president because he was a member.
Exactly. No, that's an excellent point, was that, yeah, there have been Democratic politicians in the past who have been members or, you know, vocally supported the group. The Knights of Columbus have done some fantastic work on helping religious minorities in Iraq and Syria recovering from ISIS. And I mean, it's just, people who research the Knights would very easily find out that they're focused on charitable works, and their positions, what the issue was that it was Senators Hirano and Harris brought up in their questioning, was on their opposition to abortion and their support of traditional marriage.
Right.
And those positions are not exclusive to the Knights of Columbus. That's just their expression of loyalty to the Catholic Church's teaching on those matters. So it really is, I've spoken to different people, it really is concerning that it seems to be kind of a religious test, an anti-Catholic religious test in that sense. So.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Loretta Brown, I appreciate your time today. I look forward to carrying on our conversation next time.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me.
When I come back, I talk to Deacon Stephen Graydonis about the best films of 2018. This is Register Radio.
Don't miss a moment of 2019. Try 6 issues of EWTN's National Catholic Register today for free. Award-winning journalism that goes beyond what you'll find from any secular news service. With the Register, you'll get the real story behind the events that unfold over the course of the year. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. Want to continue your subscription after your free trial? Just pay $49.95 and you'll get a total of 26 issues filled with spiritual insights on world events, along with compelling Catholic news and information. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/NYR or call 800-421-3230 and mention code 919-NYRA. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register Senior Editor and co-host for Register Radio. Jeanette DeMello, my co-host and Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, is away on maternity leave. Well, 2018 was something of a banner year for films. The domestic market grew to about $11.9 billion, relying mainly on superhero films, especially from the Marvel and DC universes. To talk about the year that was, not just the worst movies of the year, but the best movies of the year, I have the great pleasure of being joined by Deacon Stephen Graydonis, the Register film critic. Deacon, welcome back.
Matthew, it's good to be here.
So just sort of the wide view for 2018, Hollywood seemed to have made a large amount of money, but were the films any good?
You know, in general, I think Hollywood did better this year, at least for my tastes, than they did last year. Last year, in order to put together my list of the top films of the year, I had to go pretty far afield, a lot of foreign films, a lot of indies. And while I still have some of those, there's more Hollywood in my top films list this year.
Yeah, I was thinking back. We had a very similar conversation about a year ago. And I remember thinking to myself that, boy, there were a lot of foreign films on your list of best pictures for the year, but especially films that most people will never have a chance to see or learn about.
And there are still some this year. I figure if I tell you only about movies you've heard about, I'm not really doing anyone any good. So, but you're gonna hear some more familiar titles as well.
Right. Well, let's start with a year for family films.
This was a terrific year for family films, especially since 2017 had been so mediocre in this area. Now, most of the year's better family films were sequels, but when the sequels are as good as Incredibles 2 and Disney's Ralph Breaks the Internet, I can't complain. Just a couple of years ago, I was sure that my favorite family film of the year was going to be a sequel, Paddington 2, which my family and I just fell in love with in the theater. This is a movie that in its gentleness and kindness is almost a rebuke to the freneticism and crassness of typical Hollywood family fare. But then we saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a beyond brilliant superhero family adventure from the makers of The Lego Movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It's a father-son story. It's a coming-of-age story. It's not only my favorite family film of the year, it's my favorite superhero action movie as well.
I recall the little scene in the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse where his father's on the loudspeaker.
That's, yes. Oh, that's so great.
I love you.
And yes. And there's like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. These are the two animated films where a black father who is also a police officer tells his son, "I love you," and the son says, "I know, Dad."
Well, and these helpful role models for people. I go back especially to Incredibles 2, which I will confess personally, I like the first one more than this one.
It's better. The first one is better. The second one is a step down. Still good, but not as good as the first.
But still, the whole idea of family sticking together and, mm-hmm. and family solving problems, which we need more of today.
Absolutely.
Now, any discussion of action films raises, of course, the Marvel Universe. I'm thinking of Black Panther, which mm-hmm. was probably the biggest box office win of the year. Is that correct?
Probably. I don't pay that close attention to the box office, but it was certainly huge. Black Panther was huge, and it was also good. Ant-Man and the Wasp was good. Aquaman is proving surprisingly huge at the box office, and that was fun. Avengers Infinity War, less fun.
A lot less fun, yeah.
but the best action film of this year for me by far was Mission Impossible Fallout. Tom Cruise working harder than any two Hollywood action stars half his age to entertain us. And it's also a film with a moral heart. Ethan Hunt is a super spy who cares as much about one life as millions. The only acceptable collateral damage for him is zero. And this is a genre where human life is often cheap, so I found that very refreshing.
Well, and you actually, that's a line from the film. That the man who runs him, Alec Baldwin in this case, actually goes so far as to say that one life is more important to you than millions, and which is exactly, he said, why I want you in this job.
Exactly right. Oh, I also want to give a shout out to A Quiet Place from the husband-wife team of John Krasinski and Emily Blunt. This is more thriller horror than straight action, but it's very pro-family, even pro-life. This is a rare Hollywood film that celebrates the complementarity of masculine and feminine without necessarily being totally rigid about gender roles. So A Quiet Place.
Well, Aquaman seemed also to be something of a surprise for people. One had the sense that DC was hanging its very survival, if you read the tabloids, on the success of this one film, and yet they pulled it off. I have to give you credit because I absolutely loved, I may be paraphrasing slightly, but your take on the film as a grand, glorious mess.
Yes. Well, it was certainly a mess, but I was surprised at how glorious some of the imagery was.
Yeah. And the characters I thought were more interesting than we have seen in a lot of DC films. Even the villain I thought was more nuanced than we've seen in the past.
The main thing is that it was fun, and that's something that DC has not managed to do until now. Well, that and Wonder Woman.
Yes, of course. And we're all looking forward to this year with Wonder Woman coming up, but we'll talk about more about that in a minute. Ant-Man and the Wasp, though, I thought was similar to Incredibles 2, that not quite as good as the first one, but still pretty passable.
You know, I actually liked it better than the first one, and it was certainly, I would say, more family-friendly.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about strong films, but we're also discussing weak films or weak or unreliable men in films. And I'm fascinated by that as a topic for film.
In this year especially, you know, Krasinski's character in A Quiet Place as a strong husband and father is the exception. There are some others, the father in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Mostly in 2018, family men in the movies let down their families. And I know some people will see this as male bashing, mm-hmm. but it's really just about human brokenness. For instance, Alfonso Cuarón's critically acclaimed Mexican drama Roma, which my fellow New York Film Critics Circle members picked as the year's best film, is inspired by Cuarón's experiences growing up without a father. And the film is a tribute to the women who provided stability in his life. There's also Deborah Granik's Leave No Trace with Ben Foster and Thomasine McKenzie, a touching father-daughter story about a veteran with PTSD and his tender but ultimately dysfunctional relationship with his young daughter.
And what about the Guardians?
The Guardians. This is a great example of how these films are not necessarily about like women good, men bad. This is from the director of Xavier Beauvoir of Gods and Men, and it's a French World War I drama about life and love in wartime on a farm in the French countryside, and it recognizes how sometimes the feelings of men can be bound up in the machinations of women.
Mm. So is there hope, let's put it that way, that at least in major films we're moving a little bit away from some of the cliches that we've had in the past, or is that to be expected?
I think it's always going to come down to the individual visions and passions of the filmmakers. If you, some filmmakers are going to go for the cliches, and some are going to be interested in kind of subverting them and doing more interesting things.
Well, one thing that a lot of moviegoers do not see are documentaries, and in part because in many different cities in which our listeners are likely to be living, documentaries may not even air in local theaters. So let's take a second or two and talk about some of the best documentaries you saw this year.
Very, very quickly, this was an overwhelming year for nonfiction film. I'm just going to mention some titles: Three Identical Strangers, Shirkers, Minding the Gap, Hale County This Morning This Evening. For families, I highly recommend Science Fair, about kids all over the world trying to win a prestigious science fair. For non-vertiginous viewers only, I recommend the rock climbing documentary Free Solo. But for Register listeners in particular, I want to mention two documentaries that each dealt with an iconic figure and, to one degree or another, his faith. There was Wim Wenders' Pope Francis, mm-hmm. a man of his word, a very good portrait of the Holy Father. But my favorite doc of this year might be Morgan Neville's Won't You Be My Neighbor, which, among its many achievements, highlights how Fred Rogers' faith shaped his television career and his approach to engaging children and people in general, along with Paddington 2. It's a movie about gentleness, and that's something we really need.
Well, one of the curious things for me is how a documentary like Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is a remarkable piece of work, did not seem to get the same kind of attention as RBG.
Well, you know, yeah. I think Won't You Be My Neighbor is something that is going to sort of continue to resonate with people on home video for a long time. It's maybe not the kind of movie that you have to see on the big screen, you know, like Aquaman or Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. But Fred Rogers continues to resonate with people. And, you know, you see this on the internet. Every time there's a crisis, every time there's a terrorist incident or a national disaster, people start quoting his famous line about looking for the helpers.
Mm-hmm. And for those who may not be familiar, RBG is a reference to a documentary on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Also, let's point out that the documentary Free Solo has absolutely nothing to do with Han Solo from Star Wars, right?
Yes, yes. This is about rock climbing.
So religious movies, which have been doing well over the years, certainly since The Passion of the Christ, this was a pretty good year for those, wasn't it?
It is much stronger year for religious themes in the movies, certainly, than 2017. Jim Caviezel played St. Luke in Paul, Apostle of Christ, which I liked. A movie I can't recommend to all viewers, Ethan Hawke plays a tortured pastor in Paul Schrader's very difficult film, First Reformed. This is a movie that goes to some dark places, but for me, it has a special resonance because my father was a Reformed pastor before coming into the church 2 years after Suzanne and I did.
Right.
One of the year's most bizarre but exhilarating films is based on the pre- and post-conversion writings of the Catholic poet Charles Piggy about Joan of Arc. Bruno Dumont turns his writings into a wild, hard rock musical, Jeannette, The Childhood of Joan of Arc, a film with an amazing theological vision. But my favorite film with religious themes, which is also my favorite film of the year, film that I knew was going to be my number one the first time I saw it, nothing I saw afterward called it into question, The Rider from Chloe Zhao. This is an elegiac portrait of an American Western world of people who are both cowboys and Indians. It's also about one young man's struggles with his sense that his God-given purpose in life is something that he may not be able to do anymore, to ride horses. It's a story about a young man who sustains a very serious injury and how he copes with it afterward.
All right. Well, I can't let you go without asking the one question, which is, just give me the title. What is the one film you want to see the most in 2019?
Probably Jackie Chan's Police Story, which is coming back into theaters. I love Jackie Chan. He's just an action master and a brilliant artist who unfortunately didn't make as many brilliant films as I wish he had.
Fair enough. We'll leave it there. I look forward to further discussions throughout the year. Deacon Stephen Gradonis, thank you for your work.
Thank you, Matthew.
That does it for Register Radio this week. My renewed thanks to Loretta Brown and Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Be sure also to listen to our podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, God bless.